Introduce this. This is side two of tape two of the ongoing interview with Rich and Martha Bloom, moderated by Jim Crow. Today is March 8th, 2007. Jim, I think you're ready to pick it up.
Well, Bernie Molaski was your predecessor, Rich,
right?
How well did you know him?
I got to know him. I didn't know him at all when I came here. But I got to know him along the way a little bit. I even visited him a few times when he was hospitalized, and he seemed to think that I was filling his shoes fairly well. So I mean, you know, Bernie.
If he said that, it means you're filling them very, very well.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, I took that to be a big compliment.
That's,
you know,
right.
I mean, he was quite a character.
I take it he was quite a good musician.
Terrific violist. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have heard, and you probably have too, a record of him playing some. Well, it wasn't a Paganini Caprice, but it's that kind of thing.
Well, I think he did a recording of the Stravinsky Elegy.
Yes, he did that.
I've heard that. Yeah.
That's the thing where your fingers get all tight.
Yeah. Right.
All duty. Yeah. Well, we interviewed his son. And
Who is that? David?
Well, there was David and I believe Michael, but I'm not sure about Michael because I think I put the wrong name in there. It was the only known error that I had. I probably had others, but that was the one I found out about, but it was too late to change it. Anyway, David is an English professor at DU at the time. This would have been, it would have been probably the early 90s that I interviewed him.
And, DU being?
Denver U.
Oh.
And very, very interesting guy. And because Bernie was such a New Yorkish character, Damon Runyon type character,
yeah.
You know, you would not expect to have just the quintessential Anglo-Saxon New England type professor at all. I won't say a pleasant surprise, but it was just very interesting because his own feelings about his dad came out a great deal in that thing, something that I felt I could not really put in, but he felt that his dad was one of the great violinists, or would have been one of the really great violinists, but you know, events just didn't transpire to work. It didn't work out that way, and so to be a violist in a quartet for him was a great for the son, and it must have been for Bernie too. I mean, he must have picked up on something of that nature. Was maybe something that was he shouldn't have been there. He should have been a soloist.
Oh, a come down for him.
Well, yeah. Now, David was not a musician, and he doesn't understand that among string players, I don't know, I was never in that high realm of people wanting to be, or even considering to be, soloist.
Concert artist.
And, I mean, where I grew up, it was so obvious that that was not going to happen, that I was just happy to be part of the music scene. But as a non-musician, he maybe just didn't make that transition that to be a chamber music player was indeed a great honor. And outside of being a soloist, which I think most string players actually, once they get into it, don't even, if it happens, it's an accident.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Really?
But, yes.
But like, it takes a certain kind of people, yeah. It takes a certain kind of personality, and just not everybody has, no matter how well you
play. Oh, absolutely. I mean, most people would not have this. I mean, you really have very little life. This traveling is very, very demanding.
Also, David wrote a book also.
He did. Very much like
three
his father's
quartet,
book,
right, yeah. It's similar to his father's, but of course
it's
different because he didn't
memory.
Actually the play in a quartet,
yeah.
So there was...
But it didn't make the bestseller cut, and he was disappointed with that because financially it would have been great, but it was a terrific book. Like, you know, a lot of these things about whether you end up being a solo artist and hitting the bestseller depends on how much you can huckster yourself and how much and just chance. Don't you think that's true?
Yeah, definitely.
And
of course, David, being a professional writer, knew how to get the book published. His father never did succeed in getting his book published.
Yeah.
There are passages in David's book that almost mimic what's in his father's book.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think David ever saw the book, but he heard his father tell these stories.
Oh, he never saw his father's book?
Well, I don't know. I just don't know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's a story there about what happens in the Union headquarters in New York. That's very similar in the two books. Anyhow, to go back, Bernie's most characteristic and least lovable character was to have an enormous supply of terribly filthy jokes and insisting on telling them. And you couldn't be within 5 minutes without having to listen to all these jokes. The thing I remember best, this is going to be my interview instead of the boom, if you're not careful. Shortly after coming to Madison, the Juilliard Quartet had just recorded the Bartok Quartets, all six of them. And Bernie wanted to play those records. So Ann and I went to his house. And he played all six in one evening. Well, that's a long evening.
Oh, boy.
But the evening was lengthened by the fact that between each pair of quartets, we had to listen to half a dozen of Bernie's jokes. It was one of the longer evenings of my life.
I remember, Jim, of course, when I came to the quartet, Lowell Kreitz had been playing with Bernie for a couple of years. Now, of course, the second year, but Bernie didn't do much playing because he wasn't able to. But Lowell used to tell me they'd have, after a concert, they'd have a little get-together with the people in the audience, you know how that is. Mm-hmm. And Bernie loved to just say something that was outlandish and shock people. You know, these small Wisconsin towns where you'd be playing in, I can imagine how that went over.
That would be
And so we're talking about the time period of late 40s till the year before you came.
We're talking about 47 to 57.
Right. Okay.
Because his last year, 56 to 57, Lorna did most of the playing, and he wasn't really involved in the playing. But he did a lot of playing before that. They did tours, and they did some recordings. And
Kulish did know that he had MS. Mm-hmm. Lorna told me that. Mm-hmm. I know.
How long did Bernie have MS?
He knew he had it when he came here in 47.
Oh, well, you were saying that yesterday.
Yes, when I met him in 48, and that's right. First things he said. And I don't know how long he'd had it then, but at that time he seemed perfectly normal. You know,
couldn't tell.
Difficulty walking and the things that happened later, they were 4 or 5 years later. Mm-hmm.
Well, the interesting thing in that blurb on the CD set, it mentions Kulish playing after he left Europe in New York with different people trying to keep some kind of a quartet going. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the concerts, Bernie played with him in New York before. So Kulish obviously had played with Bernie and knew his playing before he was hired.
And I think his son was probably right. I didn't ever have the pleasure of hearing him at that time, but I'm sure that he was a fantastic player. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure it was too.
Now, were these good years for the Pro Arty in the early 50s with Kulish and Kreitz?
So.
Jim could probably tell more about that than
I would certainly say
around.
So, because they must have been totally different than the Brussels group with Kulish as the leader.
Yes,
But I remember reading a review in the New York paper that the Pro Arty gave a good concert in New York, but with a different tone. It was Viennese now rather than in Belgium.
Although I don't think Kulish had a Viennese tone.
I don't either. I was always disappointed that Kulish didn't sound better.
That's the basic sound. Uh-huh. But see, that wasn't in his vocabulary. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wasn't something he even talked about. He talked about rhythm, he talked about intonation, he wanted a certain type of intonation that we worked on, and the rhythm we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. But sound? Loud and soft was his main sound thing, beautiful. As a matter of fact, he says in this brochure, a composer doesn't write, he was talking about a sonata because he wants to hear a beautiful sound. That was Kulish's idea.
I would disagree with that.
Well, I do too. I met, as I mentioned yesterday, I met Kulish. I'm sorry, Kulish and Molluski at the same time, actually.
Okay.
There was a man named Wild who was a professor of soils here.
Uh-huh.
I'd heard about him before he came to Madison. His reputation for these wild parties preceded me. And as soon as I went to the party, I knew I was the same guy. That's what I heard. Anyhow, he served enormous amounts of drink.
Yeah.
And he was a viola player, actually. I think you never met him, probably. You're just as
no,
well.
No, I don't remember him.
He's a terrible player. But during this party, he started lecturing Kulish on Beethoven tempos.
Uh-oh.
And I just thought that would cause an explosion. Well, Kulish was extremely polite. He just tolerated
it. Oh, I can see
him.
Talk
Is that true?
I can just see him.
Right.
Oh.
Now, when we get on later, I can tell you some interesting stories about touring with Kulish, but
I will look forward to those.
That, so.
Well, after Malofsky could no longer play professionally, he still wanted to play. And I played string quartets with him for two or three years.
He played violin then.
He played violin then.
Yeah.
Okay. He and I suspect this was the way Kolisch would have done it. We played Opus 135, I remember, Beethoven. Oh. And that beginning goes, da 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 da. Well, we did that over and over again.
That sounds like something, yeah, right?
I thought so.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, this went on for two or three years until he could no longer play at all. And then I got his viola, which is a nice thing.
That's right,
for me.
Yeah. Now, when did he stop playing with the Pro Arti?
Well, the spring, I guess, of 56.
56, 57.
Oh, he was still playing right up.
No, the spring of 55. Because Lorna was 55,
56. All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Rich came in.
I came in 57, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, fall
no,
of 57.
No, I don't know that he didn't try to play in the fall of 55. We don't know that. Uh-huh. We never heard anything about that.
Well, I can remember seeing him play when he was having, when his walking wasn't quite normal. Mm-hmm. You probably noticed it too.
Yeah.
And he actually fell down one time.
Okay.
I wasn't present, but they told about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
awful.
And how long did Bernie stay in Madison after he no longer played with the Pro Arti?
Well, I'd have to guess, but maybe
2 years.
Short time.
Because
then he moved to Milwaukee.
He went to Milwaukee then.
But he did have a year that he went and played in the San Francisco
right.
Symphony,
mm-hmm.
and he said he couldn't do it because he couldn't handle the hills there,
mm-hmm.
which I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that was before we came, or maybe that was during the time Lorna. I bet that was.
I bet it was that time, but I don't know either.
Yeah, I think he had just a leave of absence, maybe, and not, you know, a real...
Well, anyhow, when I was seeing him regularly, I don't remember how long this took, but after a while afterward, he had to stop playing, and then fairly shortly after that time, he moved to Milwaukee.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And...
For the record, his wife was a very fine artist, and
she was great.
She was offered a professorship at the UWM.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And he went, so.
And everybody expected him to die long before she did. But it worked out the other way around.
Right.
He lived on and on.
And he coached chamber music in Milwaukee.
And you probably know the woman that studied with him. She was the first desk, second stand player in the Milwaukee Symphony. Regier.
Janet Regier.
Oh, yes, we know her.
Yeah, I knew she had studied with him.
Oh, okay.
And while he was in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And then sometime later, then he moved to a home in near Philadelphia,
right.
in Pennsylvania somewhere.
Right. So that was where he ended up, yeah.
And he lived to be well into his 70s. I don't remember the age, but... he was bedridden for much of that time.
It's funny about MS, because it takes so many different forms with different people. It can go fast. Violas. When I went to San Antonio's principal viola, my predecessor was from a high school in Chicago, Lang Tech, Claude Carlson. And he went to Eastman, and he graduated and became principal viola in San Antonio, and I went to Eastman as a student. And then he got the job with the Stradivari Quartet at the University of Iowa, and there was an opening in San Antonio, and I took his place.
Uh-huh.
But he only played for a couple years in Iowa, and he had MS, and he died within a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it can happen very quickly at times. So I don't know if it's a violist disease.
We
it sounds like another violist.
String players, at least. There's Jacqueline Dupre, great cellist.
Yeah.
She had this. And she didn't live very long.
No. And it went very fast. Terribly fast. We interviewed Perry and Norman and I, you and I, went to see him at a assisted living place. He was totally bedridden.
We went over.
Was this in Pennsylvania or Milwaukee?
No, it was Milwaukee.
And I think he left there the next year. So when would that have been? About in the mid 80s or the late 80s?
I remember he was he in a hospital, some kind of a assisted unit, like he was in bed, you know.
Yeah. But, and it was very sad because he had very few people visiting him.
But the mind was still.
We should have said at the very beginning, he had a brilliant mind.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And.
Yeah.
He loved to play chess, and he played with Kolisch, I know.
Kolisch was a big chess player, too, so that was a big thing with him. Right, so.
And he had this almost photographic memory, especially, it's often worse he didn't have such a good memory for jokes, but he never forgot one.
Now, during the 50s, before you came, were the members of the Pro Arti also teaching in the School of Music?
Yes. Yeah, but it was a completely different type of music school than it is now. Mm-hmm. It was mostly a music ed school. There was not a lot of, even when I came in 57, there was not a lot of, quote, applied music people. Uh-huh. Mostly education students. Uh-huh. Not that there weren't some good players. Uh-huh. Some very good players.
Well, they had some
but it was a different type
people
of school.
On the faculty. There was a violinist named Cecil Burley.
Yeah.
And he had quite a national reputation, both as a violinist and as a composer. Huh. And he wrote, what was the piece he wrote, Adoration or... Some sort of a piece that became part of the regular repertoire of violinist in the 40s, I believe. Hmm. And I never played it, so I don't know. But anyway,
it still was
there were good people. And then yeah. Gunnar came, of course. Yeah.
But the members of the quartet were expected to teach.
Yeah.
Yes. At the beginning, I had trouble figuring out what their duties would be, and it seems to me that I got the impression, or else I knew, because I think I actually put it somewhere in the book, that they taught at their own, I mean, they didn't have to, but they did. And I had friends at the, and they, I played in the Lyric Opera, and the concertmaster there was from Milwaukee, and he had studied with Alou, and told me a lot about him, what kind of a teacher he was, and apparently he was a wonderful teacher. And did Rosemary Harbison ever have anything to do with?
She studied with Coolidge.
She was with Coolidge.
Yeah.
But I guess she would have been too young to have studied with Alou. Yeah, yeah.
I think so. The only person I knew her at the time.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing I remember her talking about was Coolidge, because she really worshipped him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when he moved to Boston, she went too. Whether is that for that reason or not, I don't know. But
I think Coolidge had that. ability to either you worshipped him totally or you were, you know, he was a black and white person.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the memories of him, I think you'll find to be not, that's why I found that book that you showed me so invaluable, because it showed that he was wonderful at times and not so wonderful at times.
Mm-hmm. The people in the music school were not only in awe of him, but I think sort of scared of him.
Oh, they were afraid of him, no
because,
question.
Because he had the ability to not say anything and just freeze you, you know, I mean, you never knew quite what he was thinking and what he would, you know, I mean, so I can remember that.
Oh, yeah, there was no question.
And we had some pretty high-powered people in the music school, but they didn't mess with Rudolph.
I mean, Bernie was probably smarter and a better player than Coolidge ever was, but...
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Do we want to get into the next phase, or how? What do you?
Yeah, I'd like to move. You come in 57. What the Pro Arti is like then, leading up to the breakup? I think in 1962.
Right.
Was
mm-hmm.
it? So
yeah.
Talking about those times and issues would be important.
Okay. Well, obviously, I came in the fall of 57. There was, I think, at least three people that actually came up and played with the quartet and auditioned for the job. But I suppose I had an inside track since I knew the cellist so well. Hello, Christ. But I don't know that. Anyway, you know, you don't know all the inner workings until you actually get in the position, and then you can work with the next group. But
see, let me interrupt with something I should have said earlier. This was when I was playing with Milosky. He wanted the cellist. And the only way that Friedlander would agree to play was if they played his quartet.
Oh,
so we did. We read the Friedlander quartet.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I've
never heard this.
And after we played it, Friedlander said, "That's good, let's do it again." And Malevsky, "No, we agreed to do it only once." and that was it. Well, that was only one time with Friedlander. But
that was just in a rehearsal, right?
No, we never did play in public. This was just my home.
Yeah.
Friedlander and Coolidge started imitating. Friedlander and Milosky started imitating Coolidge, and doing all the Coolidge mannerisms.
Uh-huh.
It was really nasty, but fun to watch.
Yeah.
Then the next time, that's the only time that we ever. Then Milosky was always complaining about having a good cellist, And then finally he said, hey, wait, I'm bringing Shallon next week. And he did. And he brought this guy. I didn't know, had any idea who it was. It turned out to be Lowell Kreitz.
Oh.
And so I think the first music that Lowell played in Madison, probably, was in my living room.
Isn't that interesting?
Is that right? That's interesting. Because I was in the, I think I mentioned it in the history that they, when they hire somebody, they hire them without really, you know, the other members having played with them.
I read that too. Especially, I think, just get, they wanted to get rid of Friedland.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Kolisch was in Europe.
So
he didn't even, I mean, it was a fait accompli. I mean, you know, I mean, when he came back from Europe,
but, I mean,
they had another cellist.
Not
I mean,
really the way to keep a quartet and happy. Somebody unknown. And Lowell was just a kid right out of...
Yeah, but of course he had...
Of course he was good.
He was a fine cellist, but I mean, he had no reputation.
Yeah, that's right.
So to speak.
And, like, and no degree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... He had gone one year at Northwestern University, and he didn't like it, and he had studied with Dudley Powers in the Chicago Symphony, who was principal cello. So he had a terrific background in cello, but not much as far as the academic.
Interesting. So Kreitz was on the Ferlardi Quartet without having a college degree?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And fortunately, he was quite capable of doing what needed to be done. He was okay, but it could have been just a disaster when you stop to think that. I mean, who in the higher echelon of the music department would have done that? I mean, would they done it
up? It's a crazy thing to do,
right? Yeah. So that happened before I came.
Right.
But I think when I came, Kolisch, he loved the idea of having two young guys who could play well, that he could teach. I mean, that was great, you know.
I bet he did.
And so we'd sit there, and he'd... We had our scores. We all made up, cut things, put things together. That was one of his absolute things. You had to play from a score, whether it was a Mozart quartet or Beethoven or Schoenberg or whatever it was. We had score parts in front of us, so you could see everything that everybody was doing. And the first year I was here, we did all of Beethoven quartets.
Oh.
So that was my initial thing. And then he had, the next 2 years, he had specific series. Like, we had Schubert and Webern. Then we had Schoenberg and Mozart, all year long. It was the same format. And I think Rudy really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
We had some good times then. It was,
who's the second violinist at this
point? Now, that was Albert Rayet, and he was a Belgian, kind of a carryover from the Belgian school.
Oh.
And he was a real gentleman, as Jim will remember.
Yeah.
I mean, just...
In the midst of all these other characters.
Yeah, right. He was just, what you think of the perfect French, you know, suave, and that's the way he played the violin.
Oh.
Rudolph was, you know, rambunctious, and it's just completely different styles of violin play.
He had a beautiful sound.
Yeah, right,
did.
And
Rudy
treated him like nothing, and I used to get so furious. I
wasn't
in the quartet, but I mean, I would go to rehearsal.
I don't know if I should say this, but I mean, sometimes in the rehearsal, we get through rehearsing. We were rehearsing in music hall, and we had a little studio there in the old music hall building. And matter of fact, there was no new building, so that's we music school was scattered all over the university, up down State Street
right.
and whatever. And we'd get through rehearsal, and Rudolph would stand up and start saying how terrible. I mean, the second violinist is standing right here, and Rudolph was saying how terrible this was. They had to play with the second violinist there and things like that.
In front of him?
Yeah,
right. In front of him.
You know,
and
I mean,
my introduction to that was my husband doesn't tell me these things, and being very nosy, I love to find them out. And I went to a rehearsal, and I was sitting next to Lorna, and I didn't know Lorna very well then. We got to know each other quite well, but. She was there to take notes to tell Rudy so he could, you know, if there's anything. Well, all her notes consisted of how bad Rayet was playing.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not exaggerating.
Right.
That was entirely what to that. So that was a very sad scene. And tell them how, you can tell it better than I, about how Rayet handled this.
Well, he was the kind of person that held everything in. He wouldn't say anything. You wouldn't know that there was anything wrong with him. And then maybe 6 months or 8 months would go by. And then one day he just exploded. I mean, it was just like Mount Vesuvius erupting, you know. And once he got that out of his system, he was back to his old self again. We'd go along. And the unfortunate thing is, the last thing we did before Rayet retired was in 1960. We had a summer project to record all the Schoenberg and Webern. You can imagine how tense this was. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we didn't even have an engineer. Lowell worked the machine. He'd get up on the cello, start the machine, come back, and we'd start playing. And it was a very tense summer. And at the end of the summer, I think we worked for 6 weeks on all these things. Ryan had one of his big explosions. And that was the last thing I can remember. And then he retired, and he moved back to Belgium. So.
Well, two things about Ryan. One is the conversation with you. I'll see if you remember it. We were sitting together, I think, something went wrong. I didn't know what it was, but you did. And I remember you were saying to Ryan, well, at least it wasn't your fault.
No, I don't remember that at all.
At a concert.
No, I don't remember that. But I know that I found him very appealing. Uh-huh. And it would just...
And it has that beautiful sound. It's really the other thing about him that probably we don't all know, and that is that Roland tried to get him to be concertmaster in Madison Symphony.
I didn't know that.
And he turned it down because of his eyesight. He said he couldn't sight read
Yeah, well, the story of his wife, who was, as I believe, incarcerated in Germany during the time he was gone. He was picked. You probably wonder how they chose him, and I tried to find out a lot about it, but they, Alu had left to go to the studios in Hollywood. This would have been maybe 40...
Prevost, you mean?
No?
Alu.
Alu.
Well, Alu, excuse
me. Yeah, it had to be Alu.
I'm sorry.
And... he was available. He got caught in the U.S. during the war, and his wife and daughters, I believe he had
both. Yeah, but it was like the priority. He was playing in a trio.
He was playing in a trio.
Touring with a trio in Belgium, and they got caught sort of like the priority got caught.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get
and
back.
And he was in Colorado Springs, and I think that he had at least a year of teaching at Colorado Springs College. And, you know, in a probably very one of the loneliest places you could be, and here his wife is... if she wasn't incarcerated in a concentration camp,
she couldn't get out of Europe.
Mm-hmm. And
she was trapped.
She finally did get to this country, and that was really kind of tragic too. I mean, that whole scene, you just can't imagine how the war can. But Nancy Steffens told me a story that I found fascinating. Nancy went shopping with her when she first got here, and she hadn't been in this country very long. And they were walking down somewhere in the, around the square, and she found a dead pigeon, and she wanted to pick it up, and so she could take it home and cook it. Mm-hmm. And Nancy, who wasn't a terribly sympathetic person, she's got to learn. That's not the way we do things. You know? I just was so touched by that story. We didn't have much contact with her. I think they took us out to dinner once, and
They lived in the. Near the fire station on Randolph, and just by the by the field there, by the
Camp Randall.
Randall, by Camp Randall. There's a fire. It was a fire station there, and they lived right next door.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I do remember in the course of the dinner, she seemed perfectly normal to me, but then in the course of the dinner, she found a chip. They took us to a very elegant restaurant, and we found a chip, or she found a chip on the china, and she kind of went. All out of proportion, and she started berating the waiter, and it was, I'm sure, very embarrassing to Raye, who was very fit in socially so beautifully in just about any kind of situation, and his charm and elegance without being pushy at it. I mean, it was just the way he was. So.
This concludes side two of tape two. This is tape number three, side one, Rich and Martha Bloom, moderated by Jim Crow.
We were talking about the quartet when I got in. I had 3 years with Raye, because he left in 60 and I came in 57. So those are three good years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Good years.
And then when Raye left, we had an opening for second violin, obviously. And I think by this time, now that I look back in retrospect, that maybe Kolisch was getting maybe a little disinterested in the whole thing. He'd been there for quite a while. He'd done a lot. I didn't realize it at the time. Mm-hmm. But this is how things go in quartets. You don't have an audition where 100 people show up and you try to figure out people that will work with your group and are good and have some background that you know, personality-wise, that's going to fit in. So we knew a violinist in Chicago named Robert Basso, who was concertmaster of the CBS Orchestra down there, and my mother and his mother were very good friends. They were both violinists, and they played duets. They went around playing duets together. Anyway, so I knew the Bassos, and Lowell Kreitz knew him very well. So we thought this would be a good person for the quartet. Jim will laugh at this, but
I remember this, yes.
Bob Basso came up and played his audition, and he played the Cacciatorian violin concerto very well. But Coolidge was sitting there with a glum look on his face. This was a piece that he absolutely abhorred. I mean, this was the lowest of the low. Who would ever play a Cacciatorian violin concerto? So that didn't start us off in a good with good rapport. But Bob was a terrific violinist. There was no question about that. But from then on, the relationship between all of us and Coolidge started getting difficult because obviously he didn't appreciate. Matter of fact, Bob was a player sort of like Raye, very smooth, very elegant.
So he was hired, I take it.
Yeah, he was hired as a second violinist. And that went on for a couple years, playing with Robert. And Robert, became more and more. I don't know what you'd say. Yeah, right. He couldn't take the pressure. Not just of Coolidge, but the whole music school, because as Jim knows, in any university faculty, whether it's English or math or science or whatever it is, there are factions and there are people that don't talk to other people, and that happened in the music school. And there was the Coolidge faction, and of course then Bob was on the other side, and I guess we had our faction. I didn't think about that. But
Bob, it was interesting because Bob did not have a personality that would take sides.
Right.
He was simply a sweet guy that didn't get involved with things like that.
But I think the pressures got to him, so he started drinking, which is not good for any kind of a person that's going on stage in front of an audience and having to do things like playing music.
Oh, he would drink before performance?
Yes.
Oh.
And so it came to a point where, and this is very interesting, not too many people know about this. We were playing a series of concerts. We had the year sort of planned out because you always plan the year, what concerts or what kind of music you're going to do. And we had played a couple concerts and we were always rehearsed. Monday through Friday it was, and we came after the concert. We came on the Monday morning, the three of us, and Coolidge didn't show up. And he didn't call us, and we hadn't heard from him.
You don't mean Coolidge, you mean Basso.
No, Coolidge. Didn't show up. We talked around and something and wondered what happened to him. And so we decided we'll get together tomorrow, and maybe he just wasn't feeling well or something. Well, it went on for a couple of days, and Rudolph didn't show up. So, and we had been kind of concerned because I don't think Rudolph was the kind of guy that had to practice. He worked very hard on his violin because I don't think he was innately, just a violinist that could get by with, like Kreisler, learning the piece on a train without even having his violin, Rudolph had to play. And so we thought his playing was slipping.
Oh.
So what to do? Our first violinist isn't showing up for rehearsals. We're supposed to be getting ready for a concert, and what do we do? So I was delegated to go over to his house on the, I guess it was, it's off University Avenue. I can't think of the street now. Mm-hmm. They had a small
house. It was near Hoyt Park.
Near Hoyt Park.
Down on the lower part of it. Mm-hmm.
They delegated me to go over and find out what was going on. And so, naively, I went over and, to see him and knocked on the door. And he let me in, and I don't know if this should be on the tape or not, but anyway, I said, I've come, the other people had sent me over, and we need to talk about what's going on with the quartet. And I saw his wife, Lorna. They had a hallway, and I guess they must have meant bathrooms and bedrooms back in the hallway. And I saw Lorna go out from one door and walk through another door with no clothes on at all, completely nude. So that was my first thing I saw when I got there.
You didn't tell me that.
I mean, there's some things you don't tell your wife.
It's safe now. This is 40 years ago.
So anyway, we got to talking, and I said the quartet was worried that you didn't show up, and we've been kind of worried about your playing. Well, that I should have never said that. I said, you know, some of the high notes you don't seem to be able to hear anymore. I wonder, is there anything wrong with your hearing? Well, you just don't say something like that. They wrote off college.
You know,
I should have known better, but, you know, I'm young and inexperienced.
Somebody that couldn't handle.
So that was, he never came back and played with us again after that. That was...
Really? He just walked out, basically?
He just, and he was still part of the music school, obviously. Mm-hmm. So then what do we do now? So luckily, Leo Steffens was there. Jim knows Leo, and a good pianist, and he was a loyal friend. So we needed to keep playing. We had commitments. We had concerts scheduled, and we had things around the state, which part of our job. So we formed a piano quartet then, and we went around the state playing piano quartets, and we played them at the music school, and called ourselves the University of Wisconsin Piano Quartet.
So you didn't replace Kolisch?
No,
It was Leo Steffens and the three of you.
The three of us.
Right.
And so for that time, which is about, almost until 67, until there was also not only the nepotism thing, but there was also the age thing. Mm-hmm. When you got to a certain age, that was it. You had to retire. I guess it was 70, wasn't it, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that that's in effect anymore.
I don't think it is because there's something in the state rules have changed, so you can't force a person to
retire. Right. I mean, you know, they've changed those rules. But at that time, so when we got to 67, Rudolph had to leave because that was his end. But there was 4 years there that we played with the piano quartet. Now, after Rudolph stopped playing with us, the tension between the faculty and the quartet, the two sides, got worse. So that made it much more difficult for Basso as far as the pressures go. Uh-huh. I mean, Lowell and I seem to be able to handle them all right, although Martha may say differently. I mean, how I looked when I came home after rehearsing it.
Well, I heard one concert in which he really played terribly.
Basso.
Yeah,
I remember that. Yeah,
he actually made out and out mistakes.
Oh, yeah. It was just a very
embarrassing. And that was the one they played at Hindemith. I wasn't playing in the Hindemith, a thing for violin, clarinet, piano, and cello. And I was backstage. And when we walked off, Leo Steffens came off first and he said, "That's the last time I'm going to play with him." So, but he was drunk.
Uh-huh.
He was absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, things didn't go. Mm-hmm. I mean, So. And this is something you may not know either. Obviously, Basso was very shaken up by this also. Mm-hmm. And a short time went by. I don't know if you remember this, Martha.
Oh, I do.
Lorraine Basso, his wife, called up and said, "Bob is gone. I don't know where he is." Mm. So we all got together with Steffens and everybody at their house trying to figure out what's going on. And Lorraine said, "I wonder if he's gone up to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to visit his father's grave." Mm. And I guess we got a hold of him somehow. And at the middle of the night, I drove up to Minneapolis and picked him up and drove him back to Madison. Mm. We thought he was going to commit suicide. Uh-huh. That's how despondent he was over the whole situation.
Well, you talked to a shrink, too.
Yeah,
and
we did.
The shrink, when he heard that he'd gone.
And what he was doing, he said, "This really worries me. This could
be
very
serious." And I guess it wasn't any big deal when you met him. I mean, he just said, "Oh, yeah, I'll come back." But
yeah, of course, he was very passive.
He was a very passive person.
But after that, he decided that he couldn't take it anymore, and he resigned. And he went down to Florida and taught at Dade College in Miami for a number of years. I guess he did very well down there. But the pressures here and the situation he was in, he just couldn't handle. Mm-hmm. And so now we needed a violinist to replace him.
So is the Pro Arti officially disbanded at this point?
Yes, yeah, I think you could say that.
Yeah, there really is no Pro Arti because
it was very, very well spelled out. I found that out when I did the history, that it was now the University of Wisconsin Piano Quartet.
And we had talked about that, and they said, no, you really, if you're not playing as a quartet, you can't use that name.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We were thinking about using the Pro Arti Piano Quartet. No, that wasn't possible. But anyway, we found a violinist. I had a friend that worked at Vancouver. No. Anyway, we found a Korean violinist, Wan Mo Kim, mm-hmm. who was available. We knew about him, good player, mm-hmm. and he came in and took over Bob's place for a couple of years, and that worked out pretty well. He was a young mm-hmm. young guy, and
he was here about 4 years.
Yeah,
right?
three and a half years.
Well, yeah.
Bob
yeah.
left in the middle of the. So it was one of those hard things to, you know, replace somebody in the middle of the semester.
And this is the mid-60s?
Yeah. This is probably 65.
Okay.
When we came to the point where Rudolph left because of his age, I mean, he went to Boston, now we had another violin opening. And Wan Mo wanted to be first violin, but Lowell and I didn't think that was the person for first violin. We said, you know, you're great, you're a great second violinist, but we'd like to look for another, quote, higher class violinist, somebody with a bigger name, so we could get the quartet going again. It was an important time. We wanted to revive the quartet as the Pro Arti. So Wan Mo decided he didn't want to stay if he wasn't going to be first violin.
Uh-huh.
So he resigned. So now we had two violin openings. Now, I need to go and figure out, now what do we do? There's a cellist and a violist, which are the lowest members of the quartet. We've got to find two violinists to get the quartet. Isidore Cohen was one of the people on our list,
uh-huh.
who eventually was the violinist in the Beaux-Arts Trio.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
He was a New York violinist, had a lot of chamber music, and a terrific violinist. And we really wanted him. Lowell had known him, and I knew of him, and we liked his playing. But he decided he couldn't leave New York because his wife would not leave New York. She was enamored of New York. She was a New York person, and she was not going to go to Wisconsin in the middle of the Midwest, no matter what happened. But
and he played in the Juilliard Quartet.
Yes, he did. Second violinist. Uh-huh. Actually, he was so kind of powerful as a second violinist that they needed somebody that wasn't overshadowing Bobby Mann. So. So. But anyway, at Eastman, I had played with a violinist in chamber music named Norman Polo from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Hmm.
Huh. And he was a year behind me, but terrific violinist. He went to Oklahoma City, was concertmaster of the Oklahoma City, and formed his own quartet called the Oklahoma Quartet.
Oh, he did? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So... and I obviously knew him well. So this was really our second choice. And Norman came up and auditioned for the job, and everybody seemed to like him. We thought that this would be a good fit for us. So he was hired. And then that left us still another, we still needed, so now we had three people looking for the second violinist. And who was at Ohio State that we knew? That's where Tom Moore was, but he was playing in the Ohio State String Quartet.
Have we been to Rocky Ridge at this time? I don't think so.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have.
That was, not Donna Coy, but that was, Gordon Everson.
You knew Gordon.
I knew Gordon Everson also from Eastman. I played in a quartet with Gordon Everson. He was quite a bit older than I, because he had been in the Army. And he was playing cello in a quartet at Ohio State University.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't the kind of setup that Wisconsin has. That was just kind of a faculty quartet that, uh-huh. you know, played occasionally. And so when you're looking for somebody, everybody calls everybody they know in the country and tries to get names or people that might be available.
Oh, is that
and,
how it works?
And Gordon Epperson said, you know, well, there's a violinist in our quartet here, and he's very good. I think he could really work well with you. So we brought him in. And Tom Moore was a very good violinist.
Yeah.
And that seemed ideal. And he said, you know, I mean, we don't expect you to stay here forever. You're probably too good for that, but would you like to be second violinist? Well, anyway, he was hired. So now we had a quartet again. And that took us through about 6 years.
Was it 76 or 70?
67.
I mean, 67 to 73.
Right.
Right.
And I take it from the university perspective that the chancellor and the dean of the College of Letters and Science were supportive of these efforts to reconstitute
the
pro art.
Well, at that time, I think they were...
Once Rudy had retired, they were very anxious.
And they wanted to get the quartet going.
But they didn't feel they could do anything about it during the time that he was here.
Right. So Kolisch really held the quartet and the school hostage in a sense.
In a way.
Well, I mean,
I never really thought of it that way, but that's essentially what was happening.
Okay.
And you know the way that the university setup works, that's the way it is. I mean, you know, unfortunately in the music school we're working with an entity that has to have four specific players doing specific things. You can't just kind of shuffle them around and
Here's the question for you all and Jim. I'm assuming that Kolisch did not have tenure.
No, I don't think he did.
No.
So couldn't the university have moved him out?
Sure, but that would have been something that
they
weren't
afraid of him as anybody else.
You know, this was an imposing figure.
I
this
think
is
so.
A world-renowned figure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. That's overstating it probably, but I mean, there was, I'm sure, a great deal of just.
And he was a great man, really.
I mean, I was never a great fan of his playing, but I liked him, and I also saw that he had something to give to people.
Going to tell you some interesting things about Kolisch, you know, touring with him. He was the kind of person that was thinking about music all the time, but not anything practical. And he smoked a pipe, as you remember, Jim. Yeah, he always had his pipe with him. And he would be smoking his pipe and then be thinking about something and stick the pipe in his pocket without putting it up. And then you'd see whiffs of smoke coming up. I'd say, Rudy, your pipe is in your pocket. One time we were getting ready to go somewhere, and I was the sort of designated driver, and we'd get university cars from the university fleet, and I'd pick up the car, and then I'd pick up the quartet members. And he left his violin sitting on the street, and we drove off, and you know, a few blocks later, somebody said, Rudy, do you have your violin? Ooh, huh? Well, hey, why? No. So we had to go back. Those kind of things. And he didn't really drive. I don't remember this. But we were up in Superior, Wisconsin, way in the northern part of the state. And Rudolph said, I'd like to drive. And I said, well, are you sure? Yeah, yes. Well, okay, I had a university car, though. It's not my car. I mean, you know, what can happen? So he got in, he got it started, and we went down the street, and I said, we need to turn left at the next block. And he just turned left right in front of everybody. I mean, there was cars screeching brakes and all over the place. So we said, stop, that's it. No more driving for you. So, but those kind of things, he was you know.
I have to tell you, Lorna had a favorite phrase that she often used when she first met people, something about why Rudy did not drive. And her immediate, do you remember her immediate answer? Well, she said, I won't let him after I had my accident. And it kind of endeared her to me because I enjoyed people that had this sense of humor, you know. But there was a lot to that. I mean, she was herself very much afraid of this and that, and so she would not be able to drive at all. But I mean, you know, it was a good way of putting it. Mm-hmm.
But I take it the three of you maintain respect for Kolisch.
Yeah.
Even despite the troubles in the 60s.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it's totally different with me. You people knew him intimately, and I just barely knew him.
I didn't know him intimately. I knew Lorna.
But you respected him, I take it.
Yes. His musical intellect, really.
Yeah.
Not so much just the playing, the musicianship.
And even though there was a big schism in the music school, you know, this way or that way, this side or that side, I don't think Lowell and I ever had any antagonism for him at all. I mean, it was kind of sad. It was a sad time.
Yeah.
He did some of his things there. They had, he would do some playing and stuff like that. Not a lot, but he did.
Yeah, he played with the University Orchestra. He did solo. Yeah.
He played with the Madison Symphony once.
Right, yeah.
I don't know whether you were playing at that time or not.
No, I wasn't
he
at that time.
He played Schubert something or other. Schubert Fantasy.
Fantasy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so. He did, wasn't there a big thing with some, I know that Schoenberg had come before we came and did something, but I think he did Piero Lumiere, was concertmaster of that little group of people that play in that music.
Who was it that came first or second year when I was playing with Rudy? Came, you know, they had big people come in, like Copeland. Aaron Copeland.
I remember
Copeland
that.
Came in
yeah.
to do a week or two of things, and the University Orchestra played Copeland. And, well, we played a Copeland piano quartet. Now, Copeland is a big name.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, he was, you know, one of the big American composers. And we played his piano quartet. And we rehearsed it with him sitting in the room, so he'd tell us that he didn't open his mouth. I think he was so afraid of Kolisch that he didn't say a word. We kept asking him questions, and he would say, oh, that's fine, beautiful, nice, nothing. So, I mean, you can see that even somebody with a reputation like Aaron Copeland,
I see.
This man, you know, bothered him. Yeah.
Rudy was, could be cruel, I think.
But he was always very polite.
Uh-huh. He could always put you down in the most polite way imaginable.
I think that maybe scared people more than, you know, people that are gruff or something, you can ignore them. But
I remember one of the incidents about it, too. There was a passage where there were half notes, 1, 2, 3, 4. And for some reason, Copeland had written at one place, it must have been the start of a new section musically, but it wasn't... I didn't know what they were doing, so I just happened to see the outside part of it. I mean, I don't know how this worked in musically, but Copeland had written 4/16th notes with slur like that, I don't know why he wrote that, because there's only one way you can play it, and that's just as a plain half note, unless you go, and it didn't, I don't believe that seemed to be called for there, but what Rudy did, he loved to be absolutely factual, and he loved to find ways to make the composer look stupid. It was in a very awkward spot, and he got into some position where he played a dotty 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 and played the same note on two strings.
Uh-huh.
And Copeland says, "Why are you doing that? I just come to pick up Rich or something." He said, "Why are you doing it?" "Oh, but." And Copeland, of course, was just speechless. What could he say? He'd written it that. I mean, that is one thing you could do. It's often then with an open string where you go da dee da dee da. But this wasn't an open note. And sure. You know what I mean? Copeland's about this big.
He had a kind of technique, at least when I was with him, that he didn't slide around much. There was no glissandos or anything unless they were written in the music. So he had extended fingerings where he could you know, crawl around the violin without having to slide around. Well, that's one thing on the violin. It's a little different on the viola. And so I had to revise my whole background of studying, because this was, and we were playing a lot of contemporary music. And my whole technique had to change. I mean, and that's when I started playing on a smaller viola. I just so. But getting into the quartet with Tom Moore there, in that era, that's when the university started pressing us for tenure.
Why did the university press you for that?
Because everybody was tenured, and why should these four people not be in the same setup that everybody else was? They couldn't understand. It's hard to understand the workings of a quartet for somebody that isn't involved with music, or even people in the music field didn't always understand what it means to be playing in a string quartet. As somebody said, it's like being married to four different people. You know, I mean, that's how intimate you have to be to work. And we thought a long time about this. I mean, we had a lot of discussions on whether this was something that would be good for us, we really wanted to do. And
was the school itself pressuring you to do this?
Yes, but you know,
no,
it wasn't overt.
I don't remember it that way.
It wasn't overt. You know, they didn't say you have to become tenured professors. But
something that they thought would be a good idea.
Well, and there is this issue that if everybody had tenure and one person wanted to stop playing the quartet, there would be no way of replacing him.
Right. And that's what happened.
The quartet, that was the quartet's view of this.
Right. That was our worry right from the beginning. But somehow or other, they convinced us that, you know, this would be a good thing to do.
When you say they, who is they?
I think the music school. We didn't deal with chancellors or presidents or higher administration. We dealt with our... But they were...
Who was chairman then? Do you remember?
Burns. No,
Burns died in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Kind or of. Retired. I don't think he died, but no. Who was...
Can't remember.
Was it Don Whitaker?
No, he wasn't.
Who was the woman who became chairman about that time?
Yeah, it was Eunice Meskey, but
that was later.
That was when Martha wrote her thing. Anyway, to make a long story short, we decided, okay, we'll become tenured professors. And then...
That put them on the, assistant. They were no longer artists in residence, but they were assistant professors, and they were on the tenure track scene. Well, you know that. But.
So that was probably around 1970.
Okay.
Because it was a couple years later that Tom Moore decided, and I never knew exactly what his thinking was, even though we were pretty close and we roomed together usually on tours and everything. He decided he didn't want to be in the quartet anymore. Mm-hmm. He wanted to become a full-time teacher, teach full-time. And we found out that on a tour to Wyoming and in Nebraska, we were touring, and that's when he broke the news to us that he was. And it was kind of shocking because he said, I've already been up to see the chancellor. And he said to me, this is okay. This is something that people do, and so we see nothing wrong with that. So he not only didn't go to the chairman of the music department, he went to the upper echelon administration, got permission to do this, and then he told us that it was...
Well, knowing Tom, I don't find that surprising.
No.
He could be a manipulator.
Yeah, he was.
Very manipulative,
A charming person. He could charm the pants off you. The Irish type of, but...
And you said he was a good violinist.
Oh, yeah.
Very good violinist. And a good teacher.
Uh-huh.
A very good teacher.
Had a good ball.
But that left us in the lurch again. But now we had no line item budget for another violinist, particularly since Tom was now teaching full time rather than half time. And so what did the three of us do? So and
were you upset?
Yes, we were distraught.
Yes. Very
if that, if that's I can remember that
because
Norman and I talking.
It seemed like they finally had a good quartet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and things were going well. We were touring internationally. We were playing concerts in the States here. We were working with, we were playing in Princeton. We were playing in Boston. Things were really good.
We did a lot of that.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we were really starting to do things,
This concludes side one of tape 3. This is side 2 of tape 3.
Okay, so we're into the tenure situation here with Tom Moore, who decided to leave the quartet. This was in May.
72.
In 72. And where do we go from here? That was the three of us had to decide what to do. So we decided, since things were going so well, and we had commitments. We had commitments for the next year. We had a tour of South America planned and tours around the country. So we went up to the music school head and said, we're under contract to do a certain amount of playing. What do we do for a second violinist? And they said, all right, temporarily, we'll hire another violinist. But we can't guarantee you that this is going to be any kind of a permanent position because we just don't have the budget for it. So we hired a gentleman named John McLeod. Mm-hmm. And he came in. For 1 year, we did our touring. I have there's a picture in it was taken in South America with
over the ambassador or something.
Right, the ambassador, with John in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were still in the old Coleridge things playing from scores.
Oh.
So I'll tell you a little aside on the tour to South America with John, who was new in the group, but worked in quite well. We were doing hard music. And we were in Bolivia. And I don't know if you've ever been in La Paz, but La Paz is a very high airport, like 11,000, 12,000 feet. And we had been playing in Brazil on the coast, so we were at sea level. And suddenly we're at, you know, 12,000 feet. And we're going to Cochabamba.
Which
Bolivia,
was low.
Which is low and down in the jungle. Yeah. So we get to the airport, and we can't get out of the airport because El Presidente is coming in, and the airport closes down, and his plane comes in. Nobody else can land. Nobody else can take off. So we had to wait till El Presidente came in, and then we could take off. Well, that took all day. So we're sitting in the airport at 12,000 feet. We all have splitting headaches from the altitude. And to make a long story short again, we finally take off in time to make our concert that night. And John, because he was as bad as we were as far as, you know, being out of it, left his briefcase there with his music in it, in the airport. So we get to our concert thing, he doesn't have his music. And, but our cellist, Lowell, is playing all the stuff from a score. So they huddle together in the concert. And John, who is new at this, I mean, this he hasn't been playing with us for 10 years, this is his first year. And we're playing a late Beethoven. And he did the concert, looking over Lowell's shoulder, sort
oh
of, and playing from the score. As you can imagine that nerve-wracking concert that was. And,
he must have been very young.
So, those kind of things would happen now and then in a quartet. Yeah. You know, there's all kinds of different things.
Well, it has to be far-sighted. It's
the black is the note, the white is the...
And as long as I'm telling funny stories, Kolisch, go back to Kolisch, was the kind of person who said, no matter how bad the music is, you do even a better job because it's your duty as a performer to do as well as you can no matter how the music was. That's mm-hmm. what he said. So we were playing a piece in Chicago, the library, by a Chicago composer, which was terrible. But we had to play it because that's how we got the concert. You know how that is.
Was that piece Chaminade or something that?
Oh,
it was a famous piece. So
anyway, we get down to Chicago, we're playing the piece, and Kolisch is sort of kind of goofing around. I mean, I was surprised. You know, of all this stuff, we have to really play this piece. And he dropped his bow in the middle of the piece with the audience there. And he reached down on the floor to pick it up, and he picked it up, and he picked it up at the tip. So he got it up there, and the frog was in the wrong place. And Lowell and I broke up. We couldn't stop laughing. And this is in the middle of a concert. We kept playing, but we got through the concert.
I never
concert,
heard
but,
that. You should have told me that. I would have put it in the history.
And then we had another incident where we used to play in music hall every Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. It was called Music and Performance. And Gunnar Hansen would lecture. And this was always fascinating because Gunnar could lecture on anything
and
at
he
any
never
time.
Stopped. he never stopped.
Sounded absolutely brilliant.
our quartet would sit on the stage and we'd do demonstrations and play a piece of music and he'd talk about it. Well, the students are very sharp. They'd get on to what was going on, so they'd ask questions of him that would get him off on another tangent completely from what we were supposed to be talking about. But you know how students are. But anyway, we were playing one day, and now Rudolph would sit there, and Johansson was in front of us at the microphone, and we were just behind him. And Gunnar would say things about the music that Rudy knew were wrong. So he'd go, oh. He'd be making faces, shaking his head, and this guy is lecturing in front of him, and the whole room full of students. You know, there must have been 200 or 300 students there. That was a big class. So you can imagine that. Well, we were playing a piece one day. I don't know what the piece was anymore, but we were using a score, as usual. But this score was pages that were all joined together in like a loose leaf folder. Uh-huh. And Lowell and Rudolph sat together. They looked off the same music. Usually. Mm-hmm. Lowell would turn the pages, so Rudolph was sitting over here, and Lowell was here, and second violinist and I were on the other side. And it was the place where Lowell was playing, and Rudolph had to turn the page. So he turned the page, and the music slipped and fell off, but it was like an accordion. It was all took together. So it was like one of those slinky toys.
Yeah.
It went to the edge of the stage and then unfolded right down into the audience. And you can imagine what an uproar that was. I mean, the rest of us just stopped playing. Those are some little things along the way that happened. So, where was I?
So we're back. You've hired John McLeod.
McLeod.
For just 1 year, you
just
said.
Just 1 year. But we couldn't get him for the second year. They wouldn't hire him for, they wouldn't continue his.
No money, or they didn't like him?
No, I think he was well liked.
Oh yeah, he was well liked.
He did his job well. He was a very serious guy. Mm-hmm. After that, he went to Missouri at Columbia, Missouri, and played in the quartet. Esterhazy Quartet, University of Missouri. So he was
good.
He got a good job, which is fine. We were very happy for him.
He's still there.
And as you mentioned in here, the first violinist of that quartet is
was the people of Norman.
Ava Seckley.
She was a student.
So now we were left again with a second violin vacancy, and we didn't want to quit. The indomitable spirit. We wanted to keep this quartet going.
And the priority is doing well.
Yeah,
I take
we're,
it.
We're, yeah. yeah we've well. Got we've got concerts. We've even got a manager, and so we decided to interview some second violinists, even though we didn't have any money. And Rosemary Harbison came in and played for us.
Oh, I didn't know.
And
this.
Martha came in and played for us. And was there anybody else? I can't remember. I thought we were thinking about another person. I'm not sure we brought her in. And I had to sort of excuse myself because when they're talking about Martha, I mean obviously I've got a vested interest here.
Your vested interest was probably to vote against
her. Oh,
so the other two players, Norman Polo and Lowell Kreitz, decided that Martha was the one we should try. She was here, and a good player, and had a good background and everything. So we hired Martha, but we hired her, and there was no money. I mean, she had a job, but she wasn't being paid, except for the concerts we had, the touring concerts and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And so we decided that since the music school wasn't really supporting the quartet, that we wouldn't play in the music school. So we set up our series at the Unitarian Church on University Avenue.
Oh.
And played the next year at the Unitarian Church.
We had a pretty good following here in the town. It wasn't, chamber music followings are usually not ever big.
Uh-huh.
And
but they were loyal.
They were
very
loyal,
loyal
and very knowledgeable and very much what you expect. Mm-hmm. And
so that went on for a couple of years. Now, of course, with there being no quartet at the music school per se, that meant that Norman and I and Lowell didn't have a half-time teaching load, half-time playing. We were suddenly full-time teaching. But we still tried to keep the quartet going. So we had a load and a half, actually, even though we weren't being paid for that. So
I think that only went on for 1 year.
Well, I thought it was two.
I thought it was, well, anyway.
But then Lowell decided that he didn't want to play in a quartet. He wanted to teach, and he was the assistant director of the music school. He became assistant director of the music school. So that left us now with a cello opening. And we decided to, Perry was studying with Lowell, right? And terrific cellist, Perry Karp.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked Perry if he'd like to join the group.
Well, we auditioned other people too.
Yeah, we did. But
because
I mean,
that was during the auditions happened during the time of that ice out. Were you living in Madison when they had the
In February of 76.
Yeah, right. That's
and we had no way. We'd make an appointment, and I remember one of the people that came, White.
That's right. There was other people, right?
That came. I remember him, and we had no electricity, and Norman had a stand, an antique, he liked antiques, and he had a stand that had candles holders on each side. And somehow he managed to hook up another one like that, so that two people had to use this one stand. So we did audition that way.
It got late in the year when all this was happening, and when we finally decided to hire, and I guess the music school was going to, you know, because Lowell was halftime director, so they needed another cellist there. Mm-hmm. So they were willing to hire a cellist. But Perry, being young and had graduated, and he got a job at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Mm. So by the time the university got around to finally saying, okay, let's hire this guy, he had already signed a contract. Mm. So that meant he was committed to UBC in Vancouver. And so what do we do for the next year? So this is how convoluted things got. Lowell said, okay, I'll play in the quartet for all the concerts that you do in Madison, but the touring concerts, I can't leave the school, so you'll have to use Perry for the touring concerts, even though he's up there. So we did
that. Well, we played a lot. We had kind of a triple residency to speak of in UBC there.
Right.
You know, we went out for, I think, 3 different weeks, and we were able to play with Perry, which was... I imagine they made some accommodations.
And then he even did some tours with us and other.
But
yeah,
that was a wonderful place to visit. You know what? We were talking about it the other day, and March in Vancouver is just glorious. The roses are blooming.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a very English city, and everybody has flowers and gardens. And you know, if you
yes,
come from Wisconsin in March and go up to some place where it's 65 and 70, and the flowers are all blooming,
yeah,
why
there's a lot of rain up there, and it's not that
so,
warm.
So that's
even,
the way Perry got involved with the quartet. Mm-hmm. And of course, the next year, we had a bona fide position for him, so he came in and became a cellist, and he's still here, obviously. So that worked out well.
It almost sounds like The Perils of Pauline.
Yes.
Yeah. But I have to point out, from 76 to 88, the quartet did not change. Mm-hmm.
And that was the entire period that you were second.
Well,
by
I started 2 years earlier.
Okay.
It was 2 years, because I started in 74.
Right.
Martha, for the record, can you tell what, do you remember what you played for your audition with the Pro Arti?
No, I don't.
We had a whole number of things. We had,
I can remember
we had an audition thing.
Over
and
we had
some classical things, Mozart or something, and we had some contemporary stuff. We had about 3 or 4 pieces, not the whole piece, but different movements. We had some Beethoven in there, obviously. And
I don't remember, though. I know I did have an audition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And everybody had the music. I mean, they knew what they were supposed to play. It wasn't like they just came in. Mm-hmm. Although I think we picked one piece for everybody that nobody had seen.
Oh, yeah.
That was just
reading.
A pure sight reading piece, just to see how quickly people grasp things and how well they could react to each other and stuff like that.
Now, Martha, I want to ask,
Early
on you said, when I was introducing you as professor, you said you were artist in residence.
Well,
so you never did get professor status?
No, nor did I seek it.
So were you still only paid based on performance?
I was given a half. The artist in residence was a half-time position.
I see.
Which is what the university often, and not only this university, but many of them do. They give 49% positions to a lot of people.
So they don't have to pay benefits and.
Right.
But actually, Martha was 50%.
Mine was actually 50%.
So she got
so
the.
I had a minor child here at home, and I didn't want to be gone that much from home.
Uh-huh.
And touring was a problem, having a minor child.
Actually, it was a couple of children.
A couple of children.
Yeah, at that time there were two kids still here at home.